My word. A panel game devised by Tony Shrine and Edward J. Mason. Dillis Farn and Frank Muir challenge Anne Scott James and John Wells in a game of my words, with Jack Longland in the chair.
We go straight into the first round, which tests their respective vocabularies. For 2 marks, what's the dictionary meaning of the following words? Beginning with John Wells. John, pantisocracy. Pant like pant, and then I-S-O-C-R-A-C-Y, pantisocracy.
Panta, the white bear with the black eyes. Pantarai out in Minai. I think it's probably a Greek word, isn't it? We've got a Greek word here.
Very much.
Panta meaning everything, yes. And socracy meaning the lower garments. actually, you stumped me there. I think it means a society in which everybody has a bit.
Equal or unequal bits?
Well, I'd fancy equal bits.
I'll do. It's a utopian community in which everyone is equal to everybody else and all have equal power, and it was planned in a rather sort of... Yes, by Coleridge and Southey and a chap called Lovell. It never got... never took off from the ground at all. But that's what pantisocracy is.
No, the interesting thing about that was Southey and Coleridge planning it, and they were going to develop this community on the banks of a river in America. The name of the river I can't pronounce.
It's down pretty nearly in Patagonia, and then the Welsh did it later, and it didn't come off as a colony.
It's sort of sesquialtra
satirized by Peacock in a book called Crotchet Castle, and they all float up the Thames.
The very one.
I didn't know that.
Two marks. I almost gave John Wells another mark for his extreme erudition, but I'll watch that.
Don't.
Yes, Val, your turn. Macrobiotic, M-A-C-R-O, and then biotic. Macrobiotic.
Macrobiotic.
Nuts.
Well, after this exhibition of erudition, I shall rather limit myself to saying it comes from the Greek.
Yes.
Biotic, which means kind of living or life.
Yes.
Macro, which means big or long.
It means both.
It's concerned with long living.
That's it. It's an adjective defining any means or agency that tends to prolong life or the ability to remain alive in a dormant state for years, like some of our friends, but more likely seeds you put into the ground or put in pyramids or something of that sort. 2 marks.
I think I'm mini-biotic by nature.
If it stands for length, yes.
Yes, but he said he was mini-biotic.
I know, yes, he oughtn't have said that, I agree. We'll go on.
Microbiotic.
It's your turn, Franco. Yeah. Calibogus. C-A-L-I-B-O-G-U-S. Calibogus.
I suppose, you know, those very dubious enterprises which start on the... in America, I think Amy McPherson and the Hot Gospeler and Flower Power and Group Sex for Therapy, they're all very bogus. And they all seem to arise in the pleasant sunshine of California. And modern sociologists rather describe those as calibogus. those curious movements which arise from California.
You're right about... it being American, but I think the word is first found in 1785 when California hadn't been discovered, at least not by the
United States.
Well,
I'll accept the half mark.
Beautifully bogus, surely, isn't it? Beautifully bogus.
Tastefully bogus.
Tastefully bogus. Yeah. Oh, beautifully bogus.
As in...
Yes, calligraphy.
Or cauliflower.
Yes. Yes, much more like that.
It's an American cauliflower.
I'm going to give you one out of two. It's an American-inspired alcoholic drink made by mixing rum with spruce beer. The spruce beer being a fermented beverage made from the leaves and branches of the spruce fir. It sounds absolutely horrible.
Doesn't it?
Yes. Yes. But it did start in 1785. Anne Scott James, phthisis or phthisis... P-H-T-H-I-S-I-S. You can pronounce it either way.
We're rather going in for Greek words tonight.
We are.
And it means
a declining or a thinning. I think it's
originally
used...
yes, and then it came to be associated with a particular disease.
I just thought with what the Brontes had, consumption.
Yes.
A consumption.
Yes, it was all called consumption.
Too far family.
A progressive wasting disease, often taking the form of pulmonary consumption or tuberculosis, and as we said, it comes from a Greek word meaning wasting away or decaying. Now, a round of assorted anachronisms for 2 marks from the following somewhat contrived sentences. Please identify the given fact that is historically impossible. So you've got a number of facts which are possible historically from the point of view of dating, and in each of these there is one fact which couldn't be true by reason of dating. John Wells. At the Great Exhibition, Charles Dickens was observed to light his cigar with a safety match before disappearing into a gentleman's convenience. I want the anomaly.
Charles Dickens obviously was knocking around at the time of the Great Exhibition.
Yes.
Whether or not he was knocking in and out of gentlemen's conveniences, that's where I sniff trouble, the gentleman's convenience. Because the safety match, someone looked up the other day and told me that they were going in time for... Someone was working in a play which was set in 1830, and they told me that... Yes. That was the first Lucifer in the early 1830s.
That's right.
So I reckon it's the match. I would guess the match.
Well done, John. It's absolutely right.
Good, good.
Great Exhibition was 1851. Charles Dickens died in 1870. Cigars, the first British reference to them, I don't know about the Americas, is 1821. And gentlemen's conveniences were installed for the first time for the Great Exhibition in 1851. But the safety match didn't come along here until 1855. So there is the anomaly.
A small rider...
Sir.
...or jockey... is that they first charged for the gentleman's conveniences, and that was the origin of Spend a Penny.
Yes, Fowle, your turn. Weeping copiously at the news of Shakespeare's death, the Reverend Mr. Mitten had the misfortune to drop his glass eye into a cup of China tea.
Or his China eye into a glass of...
Wait a minute. Shakespeare's death...
Yes, and the Reverend Mr. Mitten...
The only Mitten I know is kind of Mad Jack Mitten.
That's right.
Later.
He was the chap who set fire to his nightshirt because he had hiccups.
So it's not that...
What's wrong with that?
Carry on.
It's not that Mitten.
Not that Mitten at all.
Not that Mitten. And he dropped his glass eye into what? A China teacup?
A cup of China tea.
A cup of China tea. China tea. Now, China tea, Pope refers to China tea.
Sure.
Mistress of herself, though, China for.
Go back to Mr. Mitten, because I may have misled you a bit.
Is it to do with the Rev?
We've crossed him out now.
No, you didn't call him the Rev in those days.
Oh.
Yes, just say that clearly, and I'll give you a mark.
You would not be referred to as the Reverend.
The Reverend what?
The Reverend Mr.
Yes. The earliest recorded use of Reverend as a prefix, such as the Reverend Sidney Smith, for instance, doesn't happen until 1642. On the other hand, the word Reverend goes back to 1449, and as a respectful epithet, which you could apply to the clergy, it goes back to 1485. But you didn't talk about the Reverend Sidney Smith or the Reverend Mr. Mitten until 1642. Glass eyes, invented in 1578... China tea, first drunk in England in 1615. Indian tea didn't come until 1839. Now, Frank, it's your turn. Among the attractions at a reception given by Miss Nell Gwynn at number 18 Sackville Street, London, were a Punch and Judy show, a firework display, and a mound of banana ice cream.
God, I love it. Sackville Street Punch and Judy show.
Yes.
Yeah.
Firework display.
Firework display.
And lots of banana ice cream.
Display. Now, can one have more than one anachronism?
I don't think there is, as far as I know. We've checked a bit, anyway.
Punch and Judy is as old as the hills. Certainly
old enough, anyway.
Renaissance. The firework display is old as the Chinese, so that can't be it. Bananas, I would have thought, didn't come until the 19th century. But I don't think you'd have an address of number 19 Sackville Street, because they weren't numbered.
That's right. Street numbering in Britain is unknown before 1708. And Nell Gwynn, poor dear, died in 1687. Punch and Judy show, probably, you're quite right as far as the European continent was concerned, but it's first recorded in Britain by Pepys in 1662. Firework display goes back to Elizabeth in this country at least, and probably further. And the first British reference to bananas is in 1633, and just the year before Nell Gwynne died, first British reference to ice cream itself in 1686. Anne Scott-James. With a Pekingese tucked under her arm, Miss Charlotte Bronte sat in Haworth Parsonage, thoughtfully stirring her dry martini with a propelling pencil.
The last part was drowned by laughter. Could you fill it?
Sorry. Charlotte Bronte sat in Haworth Parsonage, thoughtfully stirring her dry martini with a propelling pencil.
But it seems to me it would so obviously be the dry martini that it can't be that.
You're quite right. You can't.
Now, what do you feel about the Pekingese, John?
I love Pekingese.
Yes, but I mean, what do you feel about their date of introduction to this country? Well, as we had China tea so early, I think they came in with the tea bags. I would put the propelling pencil as the mistake.
The anomaly is Miss Charlotte Bronte herself, who died in 1855, but Pekingese were first imported into Britain, and there was a sample given to Queen Victoria 5 years later in 1860. A dry martini was first mixed in 1860, and propelling pencils first manufactured in 1863, so poor Charlotte was dead before she could have used any of these objects. Well, now a round of origins and derivations. For 2 marks, how did the following words or phrases originate, or from what did they derive? John Wells, the upper crust, understand society.
Crust, of course, is a sort of very pastry feel about the whole question.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was the famous 24 blackbirds baked in a pie was, in order to keep the blackbirds singing, they had to have various layers, and they had a refrigerating layer slightly above the hot bubbling fruits, and then the cool layer for the blackbirds to fly about in, and the top layer was called the upper crust, and that was thought the nicest place to be, i.e. a member of the aristocracy.
I think it's a much nicer story than the one I've got, but make it a little bit simpler. I'll give you some marks, John. You needn't have a pie, in fact. I mean, if you think of crust in a more sort of... I admit some pies do have crust.
We don't have tarts on this program.
Chewy outside of a loaf. Yeah. The best bit of the bread.
Ah, the best bit of the bread.
And I think...
That's the best, yes. I see.
Absolutely right. I think it probably refers to what I think was called a cottage loaf, which had a smaller top half and a bigger bottom half, and the top bit was supposed to be rather nicer to eat.
Can't get decent crust anymore, can you?
It's so just that you can always spot a member of the upper class because they have a smaller top half and a bigger bottom half.
I give you your 2 marks and pass on hastily. Dennis Powell, your word is Pakistan.
Pakistan?
Where's it come from?
It comes from Pakistan.
Yes, but who invented that and how?
The Indians invented it.
Yes, in a very general sense.
In a general sense.
There were Scottish soldiers in India. That's Pakamak.
Stan is added on, like Afghanistan.
Yes.
Pakistan.
What not, yes.
You're getting...
We have Paki and Stan.
All right, now say Afghan. All right, A for Afghan. Now go on from that.
A for Afghan.
B for boots.
Well, we started with P.
P. Pakistan.
It's a hill district, and it's very parky up there.
I think you get no marks for Indian continent geography. We might give you a half mark for one of the two things.
In
1933, this word was coined. It was the geographical units that later formed the country of Pakistan, P for the Punjab, A for the Afghan border states, K for Kashmir. There's an I then, but I believe that's Iran, Sindh, S for Sindh, and Khan stood for Baluchistan. So it was all put together and didn't become a country until 1947.
Well,
Frank Muir. Frank Muir, a mummy, Egyptian kind.
It's a long time ago, Jack.
Yes.
They were anointed with oils and stuff and wrapped up in bandages, and that was called being mummified. Because it's the process of wrapping bandages around oiled corpses.
Roughly that.
Attractive, all this.
I'll give you a little. And the Arabic word is mum, spelt M-U-M. And what does mum,
no.
mum stand for? I want the meaning of the word mum. You're very close to it. Think of the word in English where
embalming
you wrap cloth. It's called cerecloth. Now, what's cerecloth come from?
The cere and yellow.
Wax.
That's right. That's right.
Wax.
Wax.
One and a half.
Wax.
A lot of help.
Wax.
Arabic word mum means wax, and then the word mumiya, meaning an embalmed body. The Egyptians anointed the corpse with wax, and probably with formaldehyde and other things as well, and wrapped it in this waxed cloth, or cerecloth. One and a half. And Scott James, as plain as a pikestaff.
I should think it just means as simple as having somebody coming and ramming you through the middle in a battle, and that's the end of that.
it's pretty English, this one. I mean,
it's just as simple as being whacked with a sword, or...
But it wasn't a pike, originally.
40 wax, or 40 mums.
It wasn't originally not an aggressive sort of pike, nor a fishy kind of pike.
It wasn't a pike at all.
Ah, it's a corruption, of course.
Yes, it is.
As plain as a...
Fika stuff.
Well, think of Dick Whittington going to London.
It's as plain as a bundle.
Yes, but what held the bundle?
A stick, a bundle, a stick bundle. The sort of stick on which you put a bundle.
That's it. But we haven't mentioned it quite. It's not unlike pike staff. You'll get it.
Tied with pike thread.
Mid-16th century phrase, plain as a pack staff, P-A-C-K.
Frank Headed.
Dryden says this, as plain as any pack staff, because it was used so often and carried so much luggage, gradually got smoother and smoother and plain and hadn't got any ornaments or bumps on it, so plain as a pack staff. One more.
I don't believe that, do you, Jane?
Yes, I do. Dryden can't be wrong in this one.
You're sweet and gullible.
Dillis Powell and Frank Muir are now leading at this point by one mark. Now we have an absolutely terrible round of methodology. For two marks, describe, if possible without using your hands, how you should set about the following. We begin with John Wells, and your task is carving a shoulder of lamb.
Well, it's really a matter of finding the sort of medical structure.
Yes.
And one of the simplest ways is to X-ray it, which also cooks it. And you then send a team of tiny miniaturized scientists into it to break it up and carry it about to the plates.
When you cut a leg of lamb, you must cut it in vertical slices of a thickish nature, downwards.
Yes, that's right. Same is true of one side of the shoulder.
And
it's only when you turn it up...
outside. That's, that's right. When you turn it upside down towards the inside...
Then you have to do it the other way.
You cut it the other way.
It's not a hard thing to describe, but I do see it.
Well, I'll give you the description. Yes. Hold the shank end of the joint with a fork or a napkin. Turn the joint so that the thickest part, the one with crisp skin, is uppermost, and cut at 12 o'clock downwards from the centre of the joint down to the bone.
We don't eat till one.
Continue cutting slices outwards from the first cut, finally inverting the joint and cutting horizontal slices from the underside. I think you get a thoroughly good one and a half. On
toss bone to dog.
Oh. Dennis Powell, yours is a little different. Method of applying a half Nelson.
Sitting on my hands, I've never applied a half Nelson. I was not brought up to know how to apply a half Nelson.
Well, Lady Hamilton did.
Should you...
Nelson couldn't. I think you approach your victim from the rear.
Yes. Do you?
Which is always wise. If you're being aggressive. And you slip your... arms
round his neck,
underneath
his
arms, into his armpit. You then meet them behind his neck
and chuck him.
Clench your fingers, and you've got him in a lock.
Objection,
Mr. Muir.
He can't move.
Using his hands.
Get out of that.
He is using his hands.
Mr. Muir using his hands. 3 points to us.
Well, I think it's his two marks. You are standing behind the person on whom the half Nelson is to be applied. You thrust your arm or arms under their corresponding upper arm and lock it all in by pressing your hand against the back of the person's neck. Very unpleasant, too.
You then, to break it, you tread on his toe.
Break his neck again, in fact.
No, you mean you must break the
Belcher. Yeah. That's right, yes. Yes, you tread on his foot,
yes. Oh, well.
Well, Frank, your task is a little different. It's to locate the pole star.
Well, wait till it's dark. Otherwise, it's enormously difficult. I think it's... I'm not very good at the stars, actually. I've been trying to find the Southern
Cross.
I can't find the
thing. You can't until you get to Australia.
No, I was in the South.
Oh, yes.
I couldn't find it at all. How do you find the Southern Cross? That's another question. No, it's something to do with the plough, isn't it?
Yes, that's right.
Hang on, that plough... You extend the handles...
That's right.
And there's a big shiny one, about 3 inches above...
Yes, that's right.
Hands,
yes.
Hands.
The top.
Hands up. He's hands up, yeah. No, but he is right.
Yes.
Look for the plough first, and go to the back end of the plough, the one which hasn't got the long...
The yoke.
...cove.
Yes,
yes. And take an imaginary line upwards through those two stars, the rear end of the plough. They're called Dubi and Merak, the pointers. Then, with luck, you find the pole star about 5 times the distance between these two stars, but it doesn't point very straight, so you have to wander about a bit in the sky. It used to once upon a time, but it doesn't now. And if you get mixed up, there's another thing shaped like a W, the Cassiopeia, which is located the other side of the pole star, so you've got 2 ways of finding out where it is.
I don't know about you, but I can never follow these things. The plough, it's shaped like a plough. It's not shaped like a plough. It's shaped like 5 burning bits of light. It's like mountains. It's called Elephant Mountain, because it looks like an elephant. It doesn't look like an elephant. It looks like Snoopy asleep or something.
Anyway, I think you get your 2. You've located it, all right. Now, Anne Scott James, your job is tying a bowline.
Well, first you start with 2 bits of string, and then you make a granny, and then you put a reef on top, and then you take away the bit of string you first thought of, and then you cast on 40, you do 2 rose plain, 4 rose pearl, and a couple of inches of moss stitch, and that's a bowline. Yeah.
One mark for effrontery. I'm told, this is not the way I tie it, if you take the loose end in the right hand and hold the main body of the rope in your left and put the loose end across the main body rope, you turn your left hand over from you and to the left and form a loop. You pass the loose end upwards through the loop and haul taut. I was taught, and I used to teach my children, because this is the main knot which used to be used to attach the climbing rope, that you looked at a rabbit running round a tree and then popping into its hole. And that's how you tie a bowline. 1 mark, anyway.
Without using your hands.
Stop the way I finish off my
more difficult
jacket.
Now, a quick round of attenuated aphorisms. 2 marks for correctly completing these incomplete quotations. John Wells, the cook was a good cook, as cooks go.
And she went.
Yes, it's... you're not...
Like all good cooks, she went.
Yes, that'll do. 2 marks. And as cooks go, she went. It's by Sarkey.
Sarkey, not
bracket H.H. Munro.
Yes, yes.
End of bracket.
Thank you very much. Killed in 1916. And Anne Scott James, 3 may keep a secret.
3 may keep a secret.
Complete.
But 4's a bridge table, I should think.
Go the other way.
3 may keep a secret, but 2 will always tell.
No, they're totally incapable of telling any longer.
2 of them are dead.
If 2 are dead, oh.
Is that right?
Yes, 3 may keep a secret. If
thank
2
you,
of them are dead...
Get the money afterwards, thank you.
Little assistance. This is Benjamin Franklin in Poor Richard's Almanac in July 1735. Dillis Power, the English country gentleman galloping after a fox. Complete.
The unspeakable in pursuit of the uneatable.
That's right. The English country gentleman galloping after a fox, the unspeakable in full pursuit of the uneatable. Oscar Wilde.
I've always thought that people queuing at that place which hires out morning clothes and everything could be described as the unbearable in pursuit of the unwearable.
Thank you. And Frank there kept his head and didn't advertise. It's now your turn, Frank.
Rolling Stone, you know.
Your turn is this. While I cannot be regarded as a pillar, I must be regarded as a buttress of the church.
I have to complete it.
You've got to complete that.
Complete in itself.
Because I'm... I never go inside.
Yes, put that in positive terms. You've got it right. You've made a negative.
Because I'm always on the outside.
Yes?
This is a... Yeah. It's very interesting. I was researching for my book, you see. And I came across this, and it goes right through the 18th century.
Think of the chap who was married to a very flighty Carolyn.
It's a century earlier.
It may well be, but the exact form of the quotation, I think, is can be attributed to a particular chap.
Lord Melbourne also said it.
Yes, I'll give you the exact quotation. While I cannot be regarded as a pillar, I must be regarded as a buttress of the church because I support it from the outside. Now, I think that particular form of words, Frank, may be first attributed to Melbourne, but I know that there are other versions as well.
Do you remember Dean Ing, when he retired and worked for a London evening paper, was asked by American journalists, what do you do, Dean? And he said, I was once a pillar of the church. I am now a column in the Evening Standard.
Well, 2 marks for that. And Frank Muir and de Lisbau win the entire contest. And that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
Taking part in My Word were Anne Scott-James, Dillis Powell, John Wells, and Frank Muir. The chairman was Jack Longland. The questions were compiled by Peter Moore, and the program was produced by Tony Shryan.
You've been listening to My Word from the BBC, heard each week at this time. This is the WFMT Fine Arts Network.